The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
Now, coming up on today's program, we're going to talk about renting and home buying. So even before the rent is due, a new national survey found renters of color pay higher upfront costs. We'll talk to a researcher about results from a survey. And also we'll get reaction from a national racial justice organization that's pressuring the Biden administration to protect tenants from rising rent prices. Then the Atlanta Realtors Association explains why home prices are dropping on the West Coast and rising on the East Coast. So all those conversations are coming up. But first, we'll get to this. Georgia state government will, for the first time, run its own marketplace for individual health insurance. That's under a bill signed into law by Governor Brian Kemp yesterday. Kemp says the law will help people better know and compare health insurance options and promote competition. Kemp's administration also plans to launch in July a partial expansion of Medicaid to insure some adults who are working or attending school. Now, Kemp continues to refuse a full Medicaid expansion without work requirements, a step that could provide insurance for hundreds of thousands. Georgia Power wants to raise its rates again. Officials are now considering the increase after a hearing yesterday where customers of the utility giant spoke out against the plan. Emily Jones has more.
The price of natural gas shot up last year, and Georgia Power says it needs to charge more to make up for the higher cost of generating electricity. State regulators are considering a plan that would raise rates for a typical residential customer by about $16 a month. But bills already increased in January, and more rate hikes are coming.
Do you know how many people I have buried who have suffered from heat?
At the hearing, Juanita Dixon of Savannah told the Public Service Commission that high power bills can have dire consequences.
Who can't even afford to buy their medicine? Who cannot even afford to pay their rent?
Commissioners say their hands are tied. By law, Georgia Power is allowed to pass fuel costs on to customers. But advocates stress that they don't have to pass on all the cost. Jeremy Kalin testified for the Sierra Club and the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. He says that if the utility was required to shoulder some of the fuel costs, it would have an incentive to keep them down.
There's just no economic consequence or incentive to more aggressively manage fuel costs.
The commission will decide later this month. Any bill increase they approve will start in June. Emily Jones, WABE News.
With Hollywood screenwriters on strike, people in Georgia's film industry are bracing for the ripple effects, as we hear from Marlon Hyde.
Georgia's $4.4 billion TV and film industry was already slowing down ahead of the strike. Without new scripts, production will eventually grind to a halt. And that affects people all across the industry.
It isn't just the writers that are impacted by a strike. You know, it will impact thousands and thousands of people. And it's not just people on crews.
Neil Landau joined the writers' union 35 years ago. He's also an associate professor of screenwriting at the University of Georgia.
It's hotels, it's transportation, it's restaurants, everything is so interconnected.
This is the first time the writers have gone on strike in 15 years. Last time, the strike continued for more than 3 months. Marlon Hyde, WABE News.
And finally, this year's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees have been named, and Chaka Khan will be inducted under the Musical Excellence Award. Now, along with Chaka Khan, Kate Bush, Sheryl Crow, Missy Elliott, George Michael, Willie Nelson, The Spinners, Rage Against the Machine, DJ Kool Herc, Link Ray, Al Kooper, Bernie Taupin, and Soul Train creator Don Cornelius. Pretty good class. You're listening to Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cf greateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Now, the price of renting, and I know this is not a surprise to a lot of you, the price of renting an apartment grew at a record-breaking pace last year. And according to research by Zillow, the cost is still climbing at a modest rate. In March, the average cost of rent in Atlanta, hold on, $1,955. That's up 5% from the previous year and up an additional $6 from the month before. Now, while renters across the country are taking on a greater financial burden, results from a new survey reveal there could be some other factors involved. I'm joined now by Manny Garcia. He's a senior population scientist with Zillow. Manny, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the results of that survey, you know, we've been hearing for so long that, well, there's the issue of the market and it's what the market demands and, you know, the housing plays a part in all of this. What do you all feel the last maybe 5 years why rents have just been increasing? Is it really because the market demands it and people can get it? So that's what folks charge?
So what's been happening in the rental market nationwide is the result of decades of underbuilding. We have, you know, a growing population, especially in the buyer's market. We have a record number of millennials reaching those peak home buying years, trying to form families and form households. But we just don't have enough homes to keep up. So it's causing a, you know, supply and demand disagreement that just causes more pressure on rents, and the cost of, you know, buying a home both go up together.
Does the Great Recession that occurred in 2008, does that have any, I guess, residual effects at all? You said we were underbuilding, but I remember in covering, you know, in 2008, there were people were begging folks, please rent my condo. You can have it for $4 a month. I mean, I'm exaggerating. But are we seeing any effects because of that?
Yes. That caused a real tightening of credit. That caused builders to become a lot more careful and conservative with how they built. So we are still dealing with the effects of that, because that really slowed down the ability of our, you know, market to supply more housing.
Wow. So let's talk about this survey. So first of all, this was a survey, Zillow. It was about race and rental costs, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, correct. So we sampled thousands of renters, and we found that Black, Latinx, and Asian American Pacific Islander renters reported paying application fees that were about 43% higher. So the typical renter of color reported paying about $50 for each rental application, while white renters reported paying only $35. We also know that Black and Latinx renters were almost twice as likely to say they submitted 5 applications or more before they finally secured a rental. And then another upfront cost, which is security deposits, are more likely to be paid by renters of color, and renters of color are less likely to have that deposit returned in its entirety.
Now, Manny, I want to back up for a moment, because I can imagine there's some listeners saying, well, how can you all gauge that based on if it's just an application? Because on an application, they do not ask your ethnicity or race, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. To some extent, this is the result of geography and demography.
Okay.
Renters of color, the median age is about 2 to 4 years younger than the typical white renter. That can be 2 fewer years to build your credit, 2 fewer years to build your savings. And then renters of color, people of color more largely, are especially concentrated in some of the most expensive markets in the United States.
Like
so
Atlanta.
Atlanta, for example.
Yeah.
Yes, that's a perfect example. Atlanta, a lot of Western markets, parts of Texas, especially since the pandemic, have absorbed higher rent increases. So the typical rent increase nationwide since the pandemic is about $400 a month. And Atlanta, it's $500. So Atlantans are paying about $100 more, or absorbing about $100 more in costs than the typical American. And that's being felt especially by renters of color because they're in those more diverse areas.
And you all looked at upfront costs. So take that further for our listeners. Upfront costs as security deposits and even other types of deposits. Is that what you're saying?
So we asked renters if they paid a security deposit, how much that deposit was, and if they got it back when they moved out. And pretty much at every step of that process, renters of color felt some more pain than their white counterparts. They were more likely to pay a security deposit. Their security deposit tended to be higher, and they were less likely to get it back in its entirety when they moved out.
So were you all able to come up with a number here? For example, what's the average cost for these kind of upfront fees compared to what you all were getting back from the survey results?
So the median cost of a security deposit is around $500. And we found for Black renters, so market-wide, security deposits are very common. Mm-hmm. Most renters pay one. For Black renters, as an example, it's almost a guarantee. More than 90% of Black renters reported paying a security deposit, whereas more like 85% of renters as a whole reported paying one. So security deposits are common, but they're almost a guarantee for renters of color, especially for Black renters.
And when we talk about upfront costs, you've got the deposit, which you can expect. But I've heard folks, and look, I'm being really clear, too, because I've lived in Atlanta for almost 30 years, where you've been asked to pay first month, last month, pet, something else. It's like, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And on this point, I would just stress renters really ought to do their research. The median rent, or the typical rent in Atlanta right now, is just under $2,000 a month. That's for someone who, you know, is shopping on the open market. Over a 12-month lease, that is an enormous sum of money to be agreeing to. Mm-hmm. So absolutely do your research and know your rights. There are, you know, parts of the country where fees are capped. There are parts of the country where you have the right to pay a lot of those upfront costs in installments. So make sure you're doing your research and, you know, only paying what you have to.
I have a listener here who writes, Rose, not only did I pay $75 for an application and background check, I gave a deposit only for them to come back to tell me I didn't meet their requirements for in terms of how much you need to make, she says. And she goes on to say, but then it took 3 months to get my deposit back because I had to go through an online portal. Does that make sense? Not.
Yeah. And I mean, frankly, that $75. So we did some research. The numbers I've given you so far for, you know, nationally, the typical application fee being $50, especially for renters of color. Mm-hmm. In Atlanta, that number is higher. So, you know, $75 to $100 is not uncommon in the Atlanta area.
$100 for a rental application. Manny.
Correct.
$100 for a rental application fee?
So when we sampled the Atlanta Metro in 2021, which is the last year we did that special sampling for Atlanta, we found that the median application fee for someone who paid one was $100. So, yes, it can be that high, and that's not uncommon.
Do you know how much a background check typically costs, Manny? I'm just curious if you know that.
No, I do not.
Okay, because I would imagine then the application fee is to run a background check, maybe a credit check. I guess that's fair. Mm-hmm. What's the rest of the money for?
Yes. No.
Wow.
I agree. And, you know, we see these high fees that are disproportionately affecting renters of color when, you know, they just want to secure a roof over their head. We know age, geography are playing a part in this. But at the end of the day, it is unfair that the color of someone's skin can predict how much they pay up front to secure housing.
Now, your research also found differences in the numbers of rental applications people of color had to submit. Mm-hmm. You talked about that compared to renters who are white. So for renters of color, they might have submitted more than four or five applications before they secured a place as opposed to their white counterparts?
Correct. So nationwide, the typical number of applications is two. But especially for Black and Latinx renters, you know, that number stays around two or three, but Black and Latinx renters are almost twice as likely to submit five applications or more when they are trying to secure a rental. So 38% of Black and Latinx renters said they submitted five or more compared to just 21% of white renters.
Hmm. Does the research also reveal or indicate where the people of color are charged more based on the neighborhood they chose to possibly live in, rent, or was it a case-by-case basis here? What do y'all have?
So, I mean, we didn't dig down to the neighborhood level, but it really does go back to that geographic point that, you know, Atlanta, mm-hmm. parts of Texas, a lot of these really diverse markets that have seen booming rent growth and cost of living growth since the pandemic are disproportionately, you know, being absorbed by renters of color.
Mm-hmm. Later, after this segment, we're going to talk about any type of legal protections or if there should be better legal protections for renters who feel they're being overpriced based on these factors like race. But I'm also curious, Manny, you know, prices are continuing to go up. Are you all seeing any indication that this trend might slow, that we might see rents start to decrease?
Yeah, I mean, we know in the multifamily market, so these are, you know, homes that are, you know, part of a building that has 50 units or more, a lot of that construction has picked up and a lot of that's coming online. So the supply issue that I talked about at the beginning of this segment, renters will probably feel a slight, I wouldn't say, you know, rent's not going to go down, but the growth is going to level out and be mm-hmm. a little bit calmer. So I think there's some, you know, in that sense, relief on the horizon, but I think, you know, rent that increase in Atlanta where renters have absorbed about a $500 monthly increase since the start of the pandemic, that's mm-hmm. not going away and that's just going to stay a reality.
Well, if the prices will continue to go up, I guess the question is, what about the quality of these rental properties? Are they getting any better? You know, years ago, when you thought about renting a place for $2,000, you're probably like, oh, I got three bedrooms, two and a half bath, and a garage. Now, it's like, I got a box. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you, you know, about half of homes in the United States, or about just under half of households in the United States, are living in a home that was built before, you know, a lot of major health regulations, things like, you know, asbestos, lead paint, were, you know, regulated or outlawed. So frankly, if you're moving into a new building, you are getting, you know, some real benefits. And frankly, the United States is decades behind on updating our housing inventory. Mm-hmm. So I like to see a lot of this new construction because a lot of these homes are safer. You know, they have seismic improvements. But I mean, the things that come online newly are not always the most, you know, affordable, and yeah. you know, you're not getting the same bang for your buck that you got before the pandemic or that you got a decade ago. You know, with all things inflation, prices are rising.
Well, Manny, let's try to end on a happy note here. Is there any place in the United States that the rent is pretty good and folks seem to be flocking there? Not that I want folks in Atlanta to leave me, but look, folk got to find a place to live now.
I would say I don't think there's really any major market where rents are, you know, decreasing. Things are becoming especially more affordable. Mm-hmm. We definitely see, especially Western markets, think, you know, the Southwest, are really cooling. So rents are down about just under 1% in Vegas, just under 1% in Phoenix. You know, New Orleans is seeing some relief, mm-hmm. And then, you know, San Francisco is seeing some relief, but, you know, these markets aren't really affordable to begin with. So if you're seeing, you know, really slight decreases, I know there are some affordability gains, but mm-hmm. it's still pretty painful out there.
And Manny, I have a listener says, Rose, I'm a landlord. I don't think your guest is being, truthful here. Background checks include criminal and credit. And evictions, so that can rack up, as they put it, that can rack up for a landlord. What's your response to that?
I absolutely, you know, understand that landlords and property managers, they want to run a credit check, they want to run a background check. And, you know, there are costs associated with that. And the real key here is that the cost shouldn't be different because of the color of your skin.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you all were looking at.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Manny Garcia, senior population scientist with Zillow. Manny, thank you so much for taking time. I appreciate it. We'll have a link to the results of your survey. And when I invite you back as well, you all have a lot of surveys and analysis coming out that we really, I think our listeners would like to hear. So thank you so much, Manny.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Will continue as we look at the rising cost of rents, not only here, not only in the nation, but here in Atlanta. You are listening to Closer Look from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. As you just heard, that information from the Zillow survey reveals people of color are paying higher upfront costs for an apartment than their white renters. And the question is, can anything be done about it? Well, my next guest is with a national racial justice organization that's working with federal lawmakers to solve the housing affordability crisis and also take on the issue of rent gouging. Devin Barrington Ward is communications director for the Liberation in a Generation. Devin, welcome. We've had you on for politics and...
I'm wearing all the hats.
Yeah, you were busy early in the day, too. We may be able to address some other issues you all are working on. But for our listeners not familiar with the mission of Liberation in a Generation...
Absolutely. So Liberation in a Generation, we have a very ambitious title for our organization. And the way that we believe that we can create liberation in a generation is through creating a liberated economy as opposed to the oppression economy that we currently exist under. And what we mean by that is making sure that working class people are the folks who are really at the head of the table as it pertains to our economic policy and not the current system that really relegates those decisions to be made by policymakers and their wealthy donors.
You call it a economic system that is more oppressive than generating equity and equality and all of that. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. And we, you know, if we, you've shared these statistics so many times about the wealth gap here in the city of Atlanta and the racial wealth gap across the country. And so that is, you know, the byproduct of an oppression economy that we exist under right now. And our liberated economy is one that addresses a multitude of issues, including housing affordability.
And we talk about quality of life issues, and that's what we focus here on Closer Look. We're talking about health and wellness, housing, affordability, transit and mobility.
Correct.
Education, workforce development. We wanted you to hear the results from that Zillow survey. You were here. You were listening to what Manny Garcia had to say. Was any of that lost on you?
None of it was lost on me. As a matter of fact, it wasn't lost on me because I was like, wow, I am yet again in these statistics. My family and I have paid higher security deposits first month, last month, pet deposit. We have had challenges with landlords who were not always following the law and local and federal government not necessarily stepping in to protect us and other tenants. And so these statistics that are in here will not be lost on me and many of your listeners. This is the reality that a lot of us are living under.
For so long, Georgia was always viewed as a landlord-friendly state. The legislature tried to come up with some provisions, although a lot of folks criticized that it didn't even go far enough to protect tenants. Back in January, the White House published a renter's bill of rights. But look, it's not a law.
Right.
It's not a binding law. It's not a statute.
Yet.
So this is why you're on the show. So your critique of how the Biden administration is handling affordable housing and renting, I think I know what it is, but I'll let you take it from here.
Well, celebrate what we can, which is that we have been able to bring the Biden administration to the table in ways that we have not been able to do with the previous administration before the Biden administration. And so with that being said, we are always going to hold this president and any president accountable to the communities that we center in our work, which is working class people, black and brown people, and people who are experiencing oppression under this economy. What we can say is that we have been able to work at the table And some of that work is through our House Homes Guarantee National Campaign that Liberation in a Generation is a part of, along with several other national organizations that's led by actual tenants. And the results of some of that advocacy has resulted in the Biden administration indicating that they are willing to incorporate some new tenant protections potentially. And right now we're actually in a public comment period where federal agencies are receiving comment from the public to help kind of write some of these new rules and regulations.
I've had lawmakers from the federal level, Congress, talk about, well, we want states to be able to enact some of these provisions. We don't want big government coming in. You heard that argument mm-hmm. before. So if there isn't federal protections, but for states, and it could boil down to, and Devin, you know this, mm-hmm. which political party is in charge.
Absolutely.
And who has the most votes.
Yes.
So, you know, wherein lies then is the compromise? You would rather have federal protections.
Well, we feel like there is room for the federal government to incorporate some of those protections. We know right now that the Fannie Mae and other federal housing lenders lend about $150 billion to private landlords, many of them who are connected to Wall Street and hedge farms and high stakes investment firms that are not necessarily rooted in the interest of what is happening in the community here in Atlanta. We know that the AJC had an expose that revealed that nearly 40% of the rental units in the city of Atlanta and the metro area are owned by private landlords, many of which have never seen the property, have never stepped foot in our communities, and are not vested in creating healthy and equitable communities in Atlanta and nationally and beyond the city of Atlanta.
And part of the Renters Bill of Rights, this is something that struck out to me, which was the right to organize. Renters should have the freedom to organize without obstruction or harassment from their housing provider or property manager. That's going to be a tough one, I think, here in Georgia.
Well, I think that is why, one, we want to be able to start at the federal level, because we do recognize that we have an administration currently in the White House that is more preferential to these type of conversations. And so as the hope is that as we incorporate more of these tenant protections at the federal level, it will serve as inspiration for state and local governments to follow and do the same, to see that actually when we put these protections in place, the sky doesn't fall. Mm-hmm. Landlords are still able to make a profit, but we also are now putting people in a place where tenants are no longer just at the mercy of folks' bottom line.
Here in Georgia, if you had a chance to be in front of the General Assembly and make a plea for, obviously, you would want all of these mm-hmm. Bill of Rights, all these tenants' rights here, but are there two or three that would, at least to get it going, to get the ball rolling here?
So I think one, you know, Manny, the researcher with Zillow, talked about the application fees. And I actually want to take it a step further. We actually found online in some of the comments that were submitted to the federal government about people's experiences with landlords, with the hopes that this would be incorporated into tenant protections, that there were landlords actually bragging in Facebook groups that they were making more money off of application fees than if they had actually rented the property. So, like, let's talk about that for a second. We have $100 or more application fees, right? And there are landlords that are openly acknowledging that they make more money off of application fees than they would if they actually rented the property.
So you could drag out. That's a problem. So you could have a $100 application fee for one apartment and have 30 people.
Correct.
That you're just sort of.
And 29 of them, you knew from the jump you weren't going to rent to them in the first place. Right. And so like those type of practices are predatory. Those type of practices are wrong. Those type of practices are yet again another way that Wall Street and those who are not interested in the plight of the working class Black and brown communities are making a buck off of our backs.
Well, then how do you suggest then that be monitored mm-hmm. or you just make it a law that says you can't do that? And who's going to follow up and then who's going to prosecute?
Well, government has mechanisms in place that they can tie into. For example, if you are a landlord that is receiving a federally backed mortgage, part of the provisions of your mortgage can be that you can't use application fees as a profit margin in your business structure. Part of the provisions of receiving that mortgage rate, which oftentimes comes at a very preferential rate mm-hmm. to Wall Street and private equity firms that are now in the rental business, we can ensure that if you are going to receive those rates, that rent control can be a part of the provisions. And those are not things that have to be passed by federal law. Those are things that can be done on the administrative side via the agency and rules and regulations.
And this week, coming from Andre Dickens' administration in partnership with the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta, announcing $200 million toward, you know, affordable housing initiatives and bringing more units online. The goal is for the city of Atlanta, I believe, for 20,000 additional or to preserve, in addition to preserving units. And, of course, units, depending on who you ask, they get a different definition. But by 2030, 20,000, that sounds like a lot. But is it enough?
I would say no. And so I think we need to look at some models also. If you look at the Homes Guarantee that Liberation in a Generation is co-leading, one of the things that we are also asking for is social housing, which is basically a reimagined version of public housing. And the reason why I bring that up is because it's one of the reasons why public housing did not work is because it was not locally controlled and it was not democratically run. And so you had people who were living in public housing units that didn't have a say and how their communities were structured and how the rules and the accommodations and the amenities, those things, none of those things were shaped and involved with them. And so what we're looking at with social housing is public housing that is still in prime real estate, that provides some more competition mm-hmm. to private landlords, but also allows for folks to have more say in their housing in their communities.
Well, and also with I want to focus on HUD for a moment. Well, with the vouchers, mm-hmm. you know, for those who qualify for that, and it's your rent is guaranteed.
Yeah,
and I believe, and I covered this years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, with the waiting list, the waiting list was crazy, but the stipulations and the requirements have gotten a lot better. And so there is a perception of who is receiving vouchers. And if you're a landlord, you know, you're balancing, do I want to go ahead and risk or gamble with this guaranteed money, but mm-hmm. I don't know who's renting my... Well, you never know who's going to rent your place.
Absolutely. And that's part of the reason why
vouchers, should there be some legislation that says you can't make anybody, you can't force anybody to rent to someone.
Well,
can you say, look, you should consider these vouchers and maybe...
Well, actually, you can. So we passed legislation at the city council level that was sponsored by...
But it's not federal.
It's not. But right. By former council member Antonio Brown, which was banning end of source of income discrimination, which essentially is a landlord can discriminate you based on the source of your income for how you're planning to pay your rent. We are of the belief that if the source of income is from a legal place, that it really shouldn't matter. If the income amount covers the amount of the rent, then you should be considered with all of the other renters that are applying for that particular property. One of the challenges was that we did pass that legislation, but we passed it with the acknowledgement that there was very few enforcement mechanisms mm-hmm. and that it was really something that state leaders really needed to champion.
I've heard the word, it's a tsunami, it's a crisis, it's beyond a crisis in terms of Atlanta's rental markets and what this means for people who may be low-wage earners. Mm-hmm. If the city, let's talk about the city of Atlanta for a moment, the city of Atlanta proper, by 2030, we can't get a hold of this. How do you see the demographics changing in this area?
We see the demographics shifting. We know that Atlanta is now no longer a majority Black city. I think that will continue to happen. But beyond just that, you know, earlier today I was at Fulton County with the family of LaShawn Thompson, a man who was eaten alive by bedbugs at the Fulton County Jail. The reason why I bring that up is because there are so many people at Fulton County who are there struggling with some sort of mental health crisis, which has made exacerbated their housing issues. And so one kind of exacerbates the other. If you're not stably housed, you're more likely to have mental health challenges. You're more likely to have negative interactions with the criminal legal system. And if you are struggling with some sort of mental health crisis, you are more likely to have a issue or challenges trying to secure housing. And those have real, very real public safety consequences. And so we have to start looking at housing. The problem is that we have commodified housing as a private way to build wealth for very wealthy people in this country. The majority of private landlords are folks that are connected to Wall Street mm-hmm. and are very wealthy, and they're using housing as a way to build wealth, as opposed to viewing housing as a critical form of infrastructure, just as roads, bridges, and hospitals are.
And so we shall see 2030. Devin Barrington Ward with Liberation in a Generation. Thank you so much for taking time. I really appreciate a good conversation.
Always good to be with you, Rose. Thank you.
Continue looking at housing, mortgages, rents, all of that. But look, there's a coastal divide when it comes to the cost of buying a home. This is from a new study, so we're going to get right into this. Here to explain this eye-opening trend is Andy Walden, the Vice President of the Enterprise Research at Black Knight, and also Michael Fisher, the President of the Atlanta Realtors Association. Thank you both for taking the time. I apologize, our segment may be shortened, but there's a lot of breaking news, so I appreciate you taking the time.
It's nice to be here.
Let's begin. Yeah, go ahead. Let's begin here. And Andy, I'll start with you. Someone says, wait a minute, housing on the West Coast is Rose, that's wrong. You read it wrong. And increasing on the East Coast, what's happening in the middle of the country? But let's get to the West Coast first. What are they doing out there?
Yeah, and I mean, this is something that's been growing, this divide, for the last 10 years. And really, it all kind of stems back to the follow-up to the great financial crisis and home prices bottoming out in 2012. And really, from that point forward, you've seen home prices outpacing incomes in the West Coast for the better part of the past decade. And then as we made our way through the pandemic, you saw some migratory activity out of those West Coast markets into Phoenix and Las Vegas and Boise and Austin. And it caused home prices in those areas. I mean, Austin saw 77% home price growth in less than 3 years, right? You've just seen unsustainable levels of home price growth. And so now we're seeing the opposite of that, right? Interest rates got up near 7%. Affordability pressures mounted in the West Coast. And now you're seeing prices come down there, whereas in the Midwest and northeastern part of the country where we've seen at least comparatively more modest home price growth, you're seeing a little bit different activity and a little bit firmer prices this spring.
All right, Michael Fisher, feel free to say, you know what, Andy's wrong, but I have a feeling you're going to agree with him.
Yeah, over the last couple of years, the market has been very, very strong here in the Atlanta area, particularly in the metro area, which mirrors a lot of what's going on in the southeastern United States. It's a good place to live. The costs of housing here are relatively affordable, and we've seen a lot of businesses move into the area and bring with them a lot of the workforce from the West Coast and the Northeast.
So again, as it goes back to the first question I asked in my first segment here, the demand is high. So when the demand is high, the market can control that. And so the prices just stay up. And then the inventory.
And that's on the heels of 10 years of underbuilding in Atlanta. You mentioned in a previous segment that we experienced more cautious builders, more cautious building market, along with higher costs of labor, higher costs of supplies, and all that has kind of put together into a big mixer, the market that we're in now on the building and construction side.
Wow. You know, Andy, I've been hearing, look, folks are leaving California for a, this is the way I can put it, cheaper lifestyle on the East Coast. But you think of places like New York and Miami, let me tell you something, Miami, and forgive me, my English teacher, from Miami ain't cheap. And so the cost of buying a home there is rising fast. So how's all this math work out? If you're someone listening saying, okay, you say it's declining on the West Coast, but Michael just said Atlanta's relatively affordable. I had a listener saying, Rose, help me out here. Can you take this?
It's true, right? So, Florida's kind of an odd one, right? Because it's part of the Southeast and East Coast, but it has received a lot of migratory pressure throughout the pandemic. And it's not just Miami. If you look at Tampa, their prices are up 70% throughout the pandemic at one point in time. Jacksonville up 62%. And so I think those are markets where absolutely affordability is being stretched. And when you look at what happened late last year, you saw prices start to come down in both of those markets. Now, Miami's a little bit of a niche there. Mm-hmm. Miami's just so significantly short on inventory that it's holding prices up, even though they're as you mentioned, they're really stretched from an affordability standpoint. But there certainly is price risk there in Florida. Atlanta is a little bit different story, right? Atlanta's trending a little bit more with national averages just kind of across the board. They have seen more growth through the pandemic, but affordability challenge is roughly equivalent to the national average, right? So not as affordable as, say, Ohio right now, certainly not as unaffordable as California. And so they're kind of running the middle ground where they're ebbing and flowing kind of with the national average, which was prices easing late last fall as inventory came back, but significant inventory shortages and worsening inventory shortages this spring and prices firming up again.
And Michael, this is for new builds? We're talking about people wanting new builds as opposed to existing?
There's really a shortage on both ends of that spectrum. Mm-hmm. On the construction side, definitely a massive shortage of housing at all price points. One thing Atlanta has competitively over a lot of different areas are no natural barriers to growth. So what we found is on the northern end of the city, lots of development, lots of building, but it's really difficult for builders. A lot of zoning issues, mm-hmm. A lot of challenges there with communities not wanting to welcome in builders, but more than happy to welcome in businesses that bring in a workforce. So the boundaries of the metro area continue to grow, and that's one of the areas that the consumers are continuing to push out further to get accessible housing.
Well, I want to stick with Atlanta for a moment, so bear with us, Andy. So, Michael, when you look at Atlanta proper here, you know, people want to be next to the Beltline or people want to be next to another park. But when you get out to, let's say, Union City or I don't even have to go that far. Let's say East Point, which was a hotbed for real estate for a while. Now I just talked to someone and said, yeah, I bought a house on East Point, but it was higher than what I thought it was going to be. So are we starting to see the East Points and Hapevilles, and which is the Tri-Cities area? Are we starting to see these other cities right outside of Atlanta? Are they experiencing any type of, I guess, push for folks to get a housing out there?
Yeah, I think it's pretty consistent across most marketplaces here in Atlanta, particularly by the submarkets. The pricing on a macro level, we released our most recent market report, and prices are about 1% across the 11-county metro area that we track. Mm-hmm. But that's very broad, right? Different areas within the local areas within the city, you're seeing prices appreciate. And a lot of that is just the supply is not there. We have a lot of people that would move if they could find a reasonable or a great alternative after, mm-hmm. And there's just no incentive to move right now, particularly with rates where they are.
Is there a that you want to go ahead and say live on this program? Is there an area that is sort of hidden that people might want to start looking at? Of course,
I think if you say
a neighborhood, someone's going to say, "Rose, I don't want these folks moving into my neighborhood and making my property taxes go up."
I think Atlanta's been a secret for long enough to say that the general metro area is not really a secret anymore.
Yeah, Andy, where on the West Coast then should folks start thinking about then if this continues? Maybe if I want to do a closer look from, I don't know, can I do it from Santa Monica? Probably not.
You wish, right? I mean, I'd love to do it with you out there. Yeah. I mean, the West Coast just simply is unaffordable across the board, and that's why you're seeing home prices react the way they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look across the country, the most interesting thing I saw in our March data was Ohio, right? Ohio is one of the very few places that's more affordable than its long-run average right now, even at 6.5% interest rates, and you're seeing the strongest home price gains there. So people are kind of queuing in on some of those affordable markets across the country, and you're seeing it put pressure on prices, especially with inventory being low across the board.
And so I was thinking about Palm Springs, but that's out too, huh? Let me ask you this, Andy, as we begin to wrap up, how long could this coastal trend, this disparity, if you want to call it that, how long could this continue?
You know, I think when we look at the market in general, I think it's going to take a few years for us to really come back and feel balanced. I mean, this spring has felt a little bit more like a normal spring, but it's somewhat coincidence because we've had very unaffordable housing at the same time we've had very low inventory, and so it's kind of balancing out with some modest home price gains. But we're still well outside of normal balance from affordability. We're still at half the level of inventory that we should have nationally. Atlanta's roughly half the level of inventory it should be. And so it's going to be a number of months, a number of quarters, potentially a number of years before we actually see a true and balanced and quote-unquote normal housing market.
And Michael, look, we expect another rate increase here, another interest rate. You know, I know the Fed has, they have faith in that, but how many have we had these in the last, 14 months? It has not slowed, in a sense, consumers in terms of buying a home. I mean, it's still...
Yeah, higher interest rates are not pushing buyers, potential buyers away from buying housing, and that's an issue. But part of that is because the existing homeowners aren't incentivized to move. And if they want to move, they're having to make a really difficult decision about their price point. And their dollars go a lot less farther than they did 6 months ago, 12 months ago, 18 months ago. And that's really locked up a lot of potential inventory in the marketplace.
And what is the average home going for right now that people can demand to, let's just say,
The median price in the 11 county area was $397,000 and the average was $478,500.
Wow.
Now, and that's still relatively affordable when you look at the national marketplace, which is why people continue to move here and continue to seek out housing.
Relatively affordable.
I know.
That is,
it's a hard word to say.
That's some phrasing there.
Yep.
So you agree with Andy that this it's not going to slow down anytime
soon? It's going
to
take a lot of time. I think it's a multifaceted approach. It's going to take good policy at the local and state levels to try and figure out how to unlock some of the red tape around building and construction. It's going to take rates balancing out and finding an equilibrium point that allows buyers and sellers to both freely trade, and it's going to take time.
Have you ever witnessed, I don't know how long you've been in the business, but have you witnessed anything like this before?
I got lessons in 2010, and my first listening presentation was a year-long marketing pitch, and I laugh about that all the time because right now, if it's on the market for a week, that's an eternity.
Really? Wow. Michael Fisher, the president of the Atlanta Realtors Association, also Andy Walden, the vice president of enterprise research at Black Knight. Thank you both for taking the time and I guess sharing some optimism, maybe. I don't know.
Atlanta is a great place to live.
We love
it
Atlanta.
Is a great
but
place to live.
Andy wants us to come out to California, but then again, he's like, well, ain't nothing out here, but come on. But
thank you for having us.
Yeah, we'll have you all back. This is something that's very important to our listeners in terms of housing affordability. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Razel. Tiffany Griffith is our supervising producer. Our engineer is Soria Vanderwerth. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary, but when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.